Aloha. The Department of Land and Natural Resources is compiling its Sea Level Rise Vulnerability and Adaptation Report, and it's taking preliminary findings to communities around the state. The latest meeting is today in Kailua Kona. We'll talk with the administrator of the Office of Conservation and Coastal Land. Despite efforts by many environmental groups, bluefin tuna was kept off the endangered species list this month. Sierra Club's marine team chair says that's a mistake. He'll join us later in the hour. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. What are the medical conditions that qualify patients for a medical cannabis prescription? We'll hear from a family nurse practitioner at one of Hawaii's first clinics created for that purpose. And the failure of wells in North Kona is a growing community concern.
That's the conversation for this Tuesday. We'll talk to you in just a bit. Now the news. This is The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. The Department of Land and Natural Resources is working on its Sea Level Rise Vulnerability and Adaptation Report due to the legislature later this fall. It's the first such assessment. Over the past 14 months, DLNR has been holding meetings to share some of its preliminary findings. The latest meeting is today in Kailua Kona. Although the report is not yet final, DLNR hopes the meetings will give more communities the opportunity to prepare for long-term impacts. Sam Lemo is the administrator of the Office of Conservation and Coastal Lands, and he's on the line now. Thank you for the time today.
Hi, Beth Ann.
When you have been sharing this with communities for now the last 14 months and assessing more information as you've been going along, what is it that has been coming to you that the rest of us aren't necessarily paying attention to, despite what we think we may know about some of the impacts of sea level rise?
Well, like you said, we've been working on this report for the past 14 months, and we've been conducting quite a few public meetings, and we've been meeting with government officials. We've held several large conferences trying to solicit input from people regarding the recommendations we are looking towards. But one of the things that we keep finding with studying this issue is the gravity of the problem of sea level rise facing the Hawaiian Islands and the ever-changing science that we're trying to keep pace with regarding sea level rise projections in terms of when certain sea level rise benchmarks are going to be reached and what the extent of those sea level rise benchmarks are.
So what are they now, as you are seeing the latest information?
Well, when we started this report really a couple years ago, we were trying to figure out a couple of really difficult issues. Number one was what we were going to model, how we were going to model it, and what numbers we were going to use. And so we initially went to the IPCC report, the assessment report number 5 by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And we looked at, for instance, 3.2 feet of sea level rise by 2100. That was a conservative estimate by the IPCC AR5 report. That was in 2014. And what we're finding is that even since 2014, the science has been changing. And so, for instance, there are a number of reports that have been published recently that indicate the IPCC report is potentially undershooting because they don't really consider the behavior of the ice sheets, Antarctica and Greenland, which appear to be experiencing some significant melting. And so,
is that sort of a really notable omission, or one that hasn't been accounted for that should be brought into all of this information? And if so, how are you accounting for it?
Well, the IPCC will be doing another update assessment report, I guess 5, 6, and I'm everybody's pretty confident that they will have a better understanding of what's happening with Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets, and that will surely change the predictions on sea level rise extent. So, but there's been a number of scientists and authors who are studying the issue already, and so we can consider looking at their numbers and possibly adjusting our numbers to better reflect reality. So, for instance, we're looking at 3.2 feet of sea level rise, not saying that it's a benchmark for 2100, but indicating that number could be reached earlier than 2100. And so, therefore, we're asking people to consider planning communities, planning infrastructure, and considering 3.2 of sea level rise, perhaps even now, in terms of your planning horizons, not waiting several decades or to initiate that process. The time is now to consider making adjustments for higher levels of sea level as we speak.
When you are looking at perhaps reaching that level before 2100, do you have a sense of how much before 2100? That's a difficult date for a lot of people to be able to wrap their minds around. Even, 2050 sometimes can be difficult for people to conceive of.
Yeah, unfortunately, there is no exact date. There's no magic number.
Are you talking like perhaps 20 years beforehand? I mean, I'm not looking for an exact date, mm-hmm. but some sort of, range in which people might be able to see that, 20 years might mean a very real difference in what would happen 50 years hence.
I hear what you're saying, but I can't overemphasize the importance of this issue. Let me just give you one quick example. This Sunday, Honolulu had very extreme high tides. In fact,
we've had king tides all summer.
Yes, but this one last Sunday potentially was the highest tide ever recorded in Honolulu tide gauge, and the tide was running, maybe 10 inches above the normal predicted tides. And so we're looking at already an additional foot of sea level on top of existing tides. We were told by the scientific community that, we can expect a foot of sea level rise by 2050. Well, maybe it's an anomaly, but we just experienced almost a foot of sea level rise. And so it's a very difficult issue to get our head around. So we're suggesting that people look at what we're proposing. They look at the areas that we're identifying as sea level rise exposure hazard areas, and we're asking people to consider, when they do long-term planning, to consider incorporating a sea level rise benchmark in their planning of something like 3 feet of sea level rise.
Sam, what would be some of those areas in case people haven't taken note before?
Some of the areas of... Could you come again with that question?
Well, you're just talking about some of the areas that might be experiencing sea level rise that you've identified, and perhaps that's not necessarily something that most people carry around in their consciousness, aside from hearing a great deal about, for example, Waikiki.
I talk to people about this all the time, and, you go down to Mapunapuna, and you can see the flooding going on there. It's alarming. You can go anywhere along the shoreline, the boat harbors, and there's all kinds of high tide flooding going on, which is obviously exceeding the capacity of these areas to handle to handle the situation. You see, if you walk the beaches, you can see the beach berms are getting overtopped in these higher tide conditions. A lot of low-lying areas, you'll find standing water, they call it, I guess, what the term is they use, sort of like dry land flooding. There's no rain, and yet areas that normally flood during rainfall events are seeing significant amount of water, but that's from the ocean. So it's really anywhere along the coastline in low-lying areas you're going to see, pretty significant flooding when we have these king tides.
We've got to go in just a second, and as you mentioned, the king tides, and we've been hearing about this all summer and certainly last Sunday, but people tend to forget fairly quickly. What is it that you think has to happen to bring this into to normalize that kind of conversation and make people far more aware on a daily basis?
Well, we have to do education, and education meaning we have to get the science in the community. We have to explain to people through peer-reviewed professional reports that, sea level is a reality, sea level rise is accelerating, and we're modeling sea level rise impacts throughout the state. We give people the tools then to take that and to basically turn that into policy or turn that into new plans or programs or legislation to help us make the necessary adjustments so that we can mitigate as much as possible the detrimental effects the sea level rise are going to cause for us. So,
well, we'll hope that happens. Thank you very much for the time today.
Yeah, no worries.
Sam Lemo is the administrator of the Office of Conservation and Coastal Lands. The DLNR meeting happens tonight at 6 in the West Hawaii Civic Center Council Chambers. You're listening to the conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, the path to a medical cannabis prescription. But first, here's your backyard quiz. Yesterday, the eyes of the nation were tuned to the Pacific Northwest, where the Great American Eclipse of 2017 made its first appearance in the continental United States. Idaho was one of the states to experience the path of totality, and Idaho also has an unlikely connection to Hawaii. Owyhee County, Idaho, borders Oregon and Nevada, and much of the region is made up of high desert plateaus dotted with sagebrush, wild sheep, antelope, cougars, and prairie falcons. The winding Owyhee River carves canyons between the basalt plateaus as it flows through the county into Oregon. Surprisingly, Native Hawaiians once lived and worked in this foreign climate nearly 200 years ago. On Captain Cook's first expedition to Hawaii, he observed the local maritime skills, returning ships began to hire crew members from the native population, and Hawaiians found themselves on the mainland around the turn of the 19th century. In Idaho, many found work as fur trappers along the Snake River, the largest tributary of the Columbia. To give you a sense of how many, a third of the workers on a trapping expedition in 1819 were Hawaiian men, sometimes referred to as Kanakas, or Sandwich Islanders. On that expedition, three Hawaiians were sent from the main party to explore an uncharted river that fed into the Snake. They did not return and were never seen again. In their memory, that river was given the name Owyhee. For today's quiz, can you tell us where the name comes from? A quick reminder, because you're listening to a recorded rebroadcast of the conversation, we won't be taking your calls this evening. You can always call during our live broadcasts at 11 a.m.
Aloha, I'm Grant Miyashiro with the Ninja Monkeys. If you like today's music, find the playlist at The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Medical cannabis has finally become available in Hawaii, and as it does, a growing population of patients has crowded the state's few dispensaries. More and more patients are signing up every day for a 329, a Hawaii-registered medical marijuana card. Mei Fuiomanopo is a family nurse practitioner with the Malie Cannabis Clinic in Honolulu, which qualifies people for a 329. We asked her which medical conditions were drawing people to her clinic.
The most common medical condition that we treat with cannabis in the state of Hawaii is severe pain.
Mm-hmm.
So pain can be defined as any pain that's lasted for longer than 3 to 6 months. We see a lot of people who have arthritis, who have chronic pain from either rheumatoid or osteoarthritis, back pain, migraines. So anything that interferes with kind of the quality of your life. You've missed work, you've missed school because of pain, you have difficulty sleeping because of pain.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we look at when we look at qualifying someone for severe pain.
Mm-hmm. What other conditions?
So, of course, cancer. So what we see mostly with cancer and cannabis is how cannabis works so well to kind of alleviate some of the side effects of chemotherapy. So the biggest thing that cannabis can do with cancer patients is to decrease the nausea and increase their appetite. Because mm-hmm. oftentimes what we see with patients going through chemotherapy is they drop a bunch of weight because they can't maintain. So cannabis really, really helps with that and without as many side effects of some of the other medications.
The advantage of that, the effect you just described of cannabis, was probably the first thing to enter the mainstream as far as in support of cannabis use, right?
Correct.
It also seems as if other medicinal uses of marijuana have been have come to the fore, at least in this country, in recent years. Is that accurate?
Yes. So what we know, what we have very, like, it would be hard to dispute. Cannabis works well for pain. It works well for nausea related to chemotherapy and also for decreasing seizures mm-hmm. in people with epilepsy.
That's, you know, what I guess the question that arises then is, you know, since those are pretty recognized positive effects, why did it take so long mm-hmm. in the medical community?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. It's the million-dollar question. And I think a lot of it has to do with the legal status of cannabis and cannabis remaining a Schedule I with the DEA.
Yeah, which it does to this day, right?
It does to this day. So basically, cannabis is listed in the same category as heroin, LSD, PCP. So basically, a Schedule I means that it has no medicinal value.
Mm-hmm. Given that, you have set up an operation to license people to use a federally Schedule I illegal drug. Did that create some problems getting your operation off the ground?
So there was definitely challenges. I can't say that it's been easy. You know, things from, you know, getting payment, like Square. You know, like, that you don't even consider, you don't even think about when you're getting a vendor to, you know, accept credit card payments. We had to go through a lot of red tape, ensuring my business. They actually flew somebody out from California to interview me for State Farm. So just a bunch of different...
It wasn't like opening a 7-Eleven.
Exactly. And there's only 3 providers in the United States that currently insure cannabis providers. So if you're a physician or an NP, you have to have basically a professional liability insurance.
Mm-hmm.
So finding somebody who will cover you while doing cannabis was actually pretty challenging, too.
You it's likely you keep up with what's going on in other states as well. And it really seems as if the... ascent of medical and recreational marijuana use has really produced a groundswell of support. I mean, people are turning out for this, aren't they?
Yes. Yeah. I think that we've seen it again with Colorado and Washington, and now with California. It's going to be really, really interesting to see how it all unfolds. And just also just kind of keeping an eye on Jeffrey Sessions, our attorney general, because right now the recreational programs don't have any protections, but the medical programs have protection because they've gone to some Supreme Court.
Legal protections.
Exactly. We have, so our medical program in Hawaii is well protected. And I think that our state has done a really great job, even though it's taken a while to roll out dispensaries. They've been very cautious and just very mindful of how to do it in a way that, you know, we're in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. We can't really have anything shipped over here.
Yeah.
Right. So.
Well, in your profession as a kind of gatekeeper for people to get access to medical marijuana, I would think you'd run into the possibility that some people are just going to come in and fake it, you know, for their recreational purposes. Have you encountered that?
Not really. Honestly, I think that people seek out medical cannabis for a variety of reasons. And typically, even the people that come to me that are younger have had significant, you know, like motor vehicle accidents, moped accidents. You know, they deal with chronic pain, or they've had some form of trauma in their life that's created PTSD. I service a very large young community of veterans, you know, so I think there's a lot of misconceptions. I think the misconception is that the typical cannabis user or medical cannabis user in Hawaii is like in their 20s partying, but it's actually the farthest thing from the truth. Most of my patients are, you know, around the age of 45 to 65, and it's typically people who may have used it recreationally in high school, and now, you know, they're dealing with chronic pain and they want to give it a try.
And they might have even found out about its benefits accidentally through recreational use.
Exactly. And they want to be able to use cannabis from, you know, our dispensaries where it's safe. You know exactly what you're getting. You know the percentage of THC, and you have a cannabinoid profile.
Is it coming out? Is pretty expensive?
So right now, I would say the cost is anywhere from 15 to 18 a gram. So that's above the black market price. And I think that we have to look at what you're getting, too. You're getting cannabis. You know exactly what you're getting. And when you're just buying it from somebody off the street, you don't know the variety. You don't know the cannabinoid profile. And you also don't know if it's been tested for mold or pesticides. And with my patients, you know, I work with a lot of people who are going through chemotherapy. And the only deaths that are cannabis related were from aspergillus, which was a mold. So I think it's really, really important that we have testing. And if it costs a little bit more, I think that there's still some value in what you're getting. You have to look kind of at the bigger picture.
Mei Fuiomanopo is a family nurse practitioner with Malie Cannabis Clinic in Honolulu.
Aloha, I'm Gavin Swain from HMSA, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Next week, Hawaii state lawmakers will meet for a special session to find a solution to fill the deficit of the ever more expensive rail project. At least that's the hope. Could the deal they strike mean hotels will get stuck with a tab? Civil Beat reporter Stuart Yurton is back and has a reality check. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, Beth Ann.
Okay, so we all know that last session ended. There wasn't an agreement about how to breach that gap. And then there were lots of suggestions, including that the hotel industry should, you know, pony up with a higher TAT. That went nowhere. But the expectation was that if there were going to be a special session, that there would be a really good chance of a deal. So how does the TAT play into it now? And do you think that that means that we're going to see a deal?
Well, what we're hearing is that the legislature is leaning toward the TAT for the bulk of the money to pay for the rail, which is about a $2.5 billion shortfall. So that's what we're hearing. Again, no deal has been made, but heading toward the session expected to start Monday, it looks like the hotel room tax is going to be the source of the money.
So how much of a, you know, bump up is that in the TAT? Something like, what, 1% or something?
Right. So what they're looking at is a 1 percentage point increase. So it's really more like a 10 or 11% increase, going from about 9.25% to 10.25%. So we're talking about adding maybe for an average room in Waikiki, adding about $2.35 to the cost of the room and using that to pay for rail.
When you talk to, you know, lawmakers for the story that you have up today, was there a sense that there was more agreement than less? I mean, this idea, again, of expectations running so high that there will be a solution, clearly there's also the possibility that there won't be one.
There is a possibility that there won't be one, but the idea is that, and I think the sense is that legislators don't want to go back into session and not come out with a deal again.
And I think no one really wants to see that happen either. But we heard so much from, you know, the hotel industry at the end of last session. What are they saying about possibly having to foot the bill?
Well, the industry doesn't like it. They say they're already taxed very high. The hotel tax here already is about, when you add the general excise tax, it's about 13.75%. This would bump it up even higher than that. And again, the tourists would be spending about $34 a night for in hotel taxes for the average room in Waikiki.
But so when we're talking about the hotels, so we're talking about statewide. So, you know, the neighbor islands were also complaining vociferously about this.
Yes, they don't like the neighbor island legislators. Many of them don't like the idea of having taxes paid in their islands being used to pay for a Honolulu rail project.
But is there any, you know, sort of bone that's being given to them? Anything else that might make it more attractive?
At this point, we're just waiting to see what's going to happen. Again, it's not, nothing is set yet, and we really do need to wait and see the details.
Okay, I guess that's what we're going to do, and we have not that many days to have to wait, so we'll find out soon. Thanks very much, Stuart.
Thank you, Beth Ann.
Every day we bring you a reality check from civilbeat.org. Today with reporter Stuart Yurton. This month, we learned that Pacific bluefin tuna will not be placed on the endangered species list. That decision by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is based on the NOAA estimation of over 1.5 million of bluefin in the wild, a population that environmental NGOs say is dangerously low. They also say the decision is driven by the economics of appetite for the expensive fish, often served in higher-end sushi restaurants. Doug Federley is the chair of the Sierra Club's marine team. He's in our studio with us now. Hi there. Welcome.
Good morning. Aloha, Beth Ann.
Your team is a national team. We should say this. It's not just something that's based in Hawaii. And you've been going around the country trying to make the case for why not just bluefin, but why ocean conservation needs to be everybody's business. But when you talk about the bluefin tuna, do people really understand its place in the ocean and what might be happening because these populations are so low?
I think that by and large people do not, unless they happen to be in the conservation community, which is why we like to speak out and engage with people so that they're aware of the exceptionally low numbers. I mean, we're talking about far less than 10% in the populations. We have some other numbers here as well. So when we hold forums around the country, last year we held forums around the country on ecosystems and national ocean policy. And we've also, and this year, with the Pacific bluefin tuna, we've worked with quite a large number of NGOs to speak out, to try and get NOAA to do the right thing.
And yet, just a few weeks ago, you had the denial of the petition to put them on the endangered species list. Where do you go from here with that? I mean, clearly, in your mind, the numbers haven't changed, and people's sensitivity may not necessarily be what you would want it to be. Where does that leave you and the other NGOs, including Mission Blue and Center for Biological Diversity and others, that have been trying to make the case?
we continue to speak out with, especially with, well, not just but with state and federal legislators, for one, because if we can get the get Congress or local legislators to not support NOAA in this endeavor, then that puts a lot of pressure on NOAA to actually list a species like the Pacific bluefin tuna that is it's in danger of becoming extinct at some point if we continue along the path we're on. The other things that we do is we encourage people to, we say everybody, people can make a difference. They often think that they cannot, but if they write letters to the editor, they join an NGO, they speak with their local politicians, and another very important thing to do is to go out and have conversations with people. And don't talk just with the people who agree with you, but go out and engage in dialogue with somebody who agrees with NOAA's position.
That position may be driven, and as some of the NGOs have said, by an economic need to be able to continue a practice that brings in money and a big amount of money when you're talking about a fish that can be sold for about $100,000 or so. The fact that NOAA is under the Department of Commerce, doesn't that really split NOAA's affections, if you will, for both money-making policy and policy that preserves the environment?
It truly does. I had a conversation with a NOAA fisheries biologist last year who said, unfortunately, the department is split, and it is NOAA comes under the Department of Commerce, and as a result, people within the organization get caught if they want to support the conservation side, yet Commerce comes in and says, "Well, no, we have to make sure that the fishing community makes enough money." Then their hands are tied. And, in fact, this same biologist told me, he said, we rely on you NGOs and people in general to speak out because we can't always.
When Sylvia Earle was here last fall and we got a chance to talk at length, she made the point that she doesn't eat fish and it would be great if other people stopped eating fish too. I mean, you haven't really talked about what a consumer might choose to do in not just having a conversation about policy, but saying, maybe I'm not going to have bluefin tuna, or even finding out, is that something that's being served at a higher-end restaurant?
You bring up a very good point, and we can apply this just in all manner of items that we choose to shop for. Now, we vote with our dollars, and if we believe that something should not be sold or a service isn't appropriate, then we should not support it. You can, in a restaurant, you can ask where the tuna comes from, for example. Or if you're eating a hamburger, you might ask where the beef comes from.
And we should say that this very clearly isn't the tuna that you find out in your can. That's what usually it's skipjack tuna, right? That's
correct.
Cut.
Yes.
Okay. So it's not just a matter of not buying the tuna at Costco or someplace else, but really when you're in a restaurant asking or calling beforehand, would that just affect what happens within, say, the U.S. consumer population? Because obviously there's a big appetite for this in Japan.
So it's not just in the U.S., but people do often follow what's happening in the U.S., and we have a lot of people here who have families in Japan. And so that information can be passed along, and that's how we make change, is one person talks to another person who talks to another person. So globally, it is paid attention to.
So then how would you make it trendy to not eat bluefin tuna? I mean, really, that's what you're talking about, is creating a PR campaign that would let people understand this and make it in a way cool not to be eating bluefin tuna?
Good question. So we can, I mean, in our marine team, we are used to, and within the Sierra Club, we are used to generating campaigns. And in those campaigns, you can have slogans, for example, or somehow you come out with a piece that is catchy, that speaks to that people will read, and that
will play well on social media, no doubt.
Yes, very good point. Yes.
So is there one in the works?
I don't know of one in the works at the moment in that regard. Our endeavors at the moment are largely within the NGO communities, but I'll take that back to our team, and we'll make sure that happens.
Well, we'll wait and see if we actually see it on our end of things. Thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure. Aloha. Thank you.
And Doug Federle is the chair of the Sierra Club's Marine Team.
Aloha, this is Dr. Scott Miskovich from Windward Oahu. You're tuned to Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
The answer to today's backyard quiz. A little earlier, we took a visit to a region of Idaho with an unlikely tie to Hawaii. Oahe County, a sparsely populated high desert area that borders Oregon and Nevada, is named after three Hawaiians that went missing on a fur trapping expedition in 1819. As winter set in, the three were sent from the main party to explore an uncharted tributary of the Snake River. The following spring, expedition leaders learned that they had likely been killed by Native Americans, and trappers were able to locate a single skeleton. The river and the surrounding region of desert plateaus and mountains were given the name Oahe. If you've noticed that word bears an odd resemblance to our state, you'd be correct. Before the arrival of Protestant missionaries in the 1820s, Hawaiian was a purely spoken language. When the British explorers were told, "O Hawaii," or "This is Hawaii," by natives, they recorded it as Oahe. This changed to its more familiar form when the official Hawaiian alphabet was created, but the canyon lands of Idaho, Oahe stuck.
And Beth Ann Shelley Hoist of Keala Kekua knew the answer. She's a palm fiber artist who uses Oahe jasper in her work, so she's today's winner. If you've got a backyard quiz for us, you can send it to us at talkback@HawaiiPublicRadio.org. Water flows through the history of Hawaii, and the availability has been a key issue for some time. Since January, water users in North Kona have been under restrictions. 5 of 13 wells are currently out of service. HPR's news director Bill Dorman sat down with Kavika Uehara, deputy manager of the Hawaii County Department of Water Supply, to get an update on the situation in North Kona.
Aloha, Kavika. Thanks for joining us.
Aloha, Bill. Thank you.
To start with, what's the latest you can tell us on the well situation overall?
Currently, we have 5 of our 13 sources are out of operation right now, and thus we've issued an emergency water restriction notice, which calls for limiting water use to health and safety needs only and to stop the irrigation of landscape and lawns.
And that's a message that local residents in North Kona are pretty familiar with by now. A lot of them have been on water restrictions since January. And some have said that there doesn't really seem to be a sense of urgency about addressing this. How would you respond to that?
I think with certain adjustments that we've made, even though adjustments to the water system we've made, even though the five sources are down, we still have been able to maintain a minimum level of water service to all our customers. But again, we are still asked, you know, we are in a situation where we're asking for everybody's compliance and adherence to our emergency water restriction.
You know, I realize that you're an engineer. I know the staff of the Department of Water Supply has a lot of talented engineers on board, but in terms of the oversight, is there a lot of technical expertise, for example, on your board?
I believe our board is a diverse makeup of personnel, people. There are some with, I think, engineering backgrounds, construction background, real estate education background. So there's a broad diversity on the board, yes.
It's getting back to that basic idea of why has this still been a consistent issue for so long, and what can be done to address this so that it's not an issue sort of in perpetuity.
Right. And one of the programs we're improving on is our spare pump and motor program. It's basically an evaluation of our island-wide water sources and the pumps and motors that are located within those sources, and making sure that we have appropriate pumps and motors on hand in the event of emergencies. That involves evaluating each system and seeing which motors are possibly interchangeable in not just one source, but maybe a couple well sources.
And for some homeowners, it's gotten to the point with their yards and the water restrictions that landscaping is disappearing in some cases. That can be expensive. Irrigation companies have lost business, certainly. Do you think that people are going to have to rethink their use of water over the longer term?
That is another program that we are actively working on, is our island-wide water conservation program. And it's part of our mission to be able to make sure we have enough of the water resource for, in perpetuity for the future. The education component on helping to provide valuable information to our customers about maybe more the drought-tolerant native plantings that still aesthetically look nice, but maybe use a lot less water than the water-thirsty plantings. And also, as far as like plumbing fixtures, you know, providing our customers with the information to install more of the EPA calls them the water sense products. Basically, mm-hmm. they use less water in your shower heads or in your sink faucets.
So, and do you get the sense that the county itself is making progress in this area? Is it stuck where it's been? Again, in terms of outlook?
I think there's always room for improvement, and part of that is with our department on that education and outreach side to provide our customers in the community with that type of information. And that, as I mentioned, we're working on right now.
Kavika, let me ask you this. In terms of planning, the Ironman Triathlon, October 14th, that's less than 8 weeks. I've seen estimates that, you know, about 100,000 people come in for that event. Many stay for a while. If we can reasonably expect an increase in demand on the water system at that time, what's the plan for dealing with that?
Right now, we do also have our Hualalai well and our Palani well under repairs right now, and we anticipate, based on the latest schedules, having those repaired by mid-September. And that we are actively, on a daily basis, checking the schedule on that.
And if those are brought online, do you feel confident that there's enough supply in the system at that point?
There will be added water source available. We probably would still continue with our water restriction at that point. You know, we'll probably have to evaluate our system as the sources are repaired and returned to service. A lot of the coordination will, yes, coincide with coordinating with the other county agencies, other state agencies involved in planning for events for Kona.
So for the folks in North Kona who basically at the end of the day say, Kavika, tell me, when do you think we're going to be done with these emergency water restrictions? What would you say to that?
Yeah, the emergency water restriction, right now we need to get one more of our sources back online. And for the Honokohau source, we are working right now on trying to get different options of expediting some type of spare pump and motor for that source. And at this time, I don't have a schedule on that, so it'd be premature for me to say anything about the emergency water restriction.
Let me ask you longer term, in terms of plans and in terms of getting back to a sense of normalcy, if that's even a right word to use in this context. What's your outlook? What's your confidence? What would, again, you say to the folks in North Kona?
Yeah, again, we have these other well repair projects in process right now, and you know we're hopeful and we're thinking positive that these, like the Hualalai, Palani, and then the Keopu repair projects will stay on track, stay on schedule. And Hualalai is supposed to be, by contract completion date, be done by end of October, but we're pushing the contract to get it done faster. Palani is the end of November, but we're pushing again the contract to get it done faster. And the Keopu well repair is scheduled by contract to be done by end of December this year. But again, we are working with them to expedite their processes.
All right. Well, Kavika, thanks very much. We'll probably be checking back in with you in terms of progress along the way. But thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Bill.
Kavika Uehara, Deputy Manager of the Department of Water Supply for Hawaii County.
Hi, I'm Brian Guadagno from Raw Elements Certified Natural Sunscreen. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on the HPR mobile app. Find it in Apple App Store or Google Play.
Time to check on activities going on throughout the state, and Morning Edition host Derek Malama joins us for a look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar, especially the free ones, Derek.
Yes, that's what I like.
Yeah.
I like these things.
What's not to like, right?
Okay, we'll start on Maui. AARP is screening a free movie in Kahului tomorrow. The film is The Lovers, starring Deborah Winger and Tracy Letts, and it's described as a funny look at love, fidelity, and family. You can see it tomorrow at 6 p.m. in the McCoy Studio Theater. The film's rated R and is free to the public, but you do need to register at the link on our website.
It's a rare movie, Derek, with a love story of people who are more than 30 years old.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Who knew, right?
Well, it's called Movies for Grown-Ups.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can create your own traditional Hawaiian game with natural materials at Volcanoes National Park.
Yes, it is called Pala'ie. It's an ancient Hawaiian ball and loop game, and it was played by keiki while they were singing and chanting. Mm-hmm. You can learn how to make one of your own to take home tomorrow at 10 a.m. on the Kilauea Visitor Center Lanai. It's free, but park entrance fees apply for that.
And we even have free events back here on Oahu.
Yes, on the beach at Waikiki tomorrow afternoon. You can listen to free music. The U.S. Pacific Fleet Band Wind Ensemble performs a free public concert at the Halekoa Hotel Courtyard at 4:30. And Lieutenant Kelly Cartwright will conduct the Wind Ensemble in a program called America in Concert. That's at 4:30 tomorrow at the Halekoa in Waikiki.
Pretty nice way to spend an evening on the beach
afternoon.
In Waikiki.
Exactly.
Thanks a lot, Derek.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. You can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Randall Zawa.
And I'm Bert Lum.
Next time on Bite Marks Cafe, Governor David Ige and Chief Information Officer Todd Nakapoy will join us to talk state government tech.
We'll get an update on efforts to upgrade IT infrastructure and increase the pace of innovation inside the state government.
That's next time on Bite Marks Cafe, Wednesday at 6:30 p.m.
That's going to do it for us for today. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to look again at how nonprofits need to prepare for meeting federally unfunded state needs. Nick Johnson from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities will be with us.
And we'll meet the director of Honolulu's Alive Ballet Academy.
You can comment about anything you hear on the program on our talkback line. That's 808-792-8217. Or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. On Facebook, we're at The Conversation. On Twitter, at HI Conversation. And if you want to tweet me, I'll tweet back at BKOZHPR.
If you missed part of The Conversation or any other show we air, you can find them on the new HPR app. Search for HPR in the Apple App Store or on Google Play. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Let's meet up tomorrow with more of The Conversation.